This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Carla Sapsford Newman, and this is The Bigger Picture. Today we have Professor Craig Calhoun, director of the London School of Economics. He is here, among other things, to help set up the London School of Economics Asia Forum, which will be held here in KL next April. The forum will provide an opportunity for analysis of different perspectives on the economic, social, political, and cultural contributions Asia is making to global development. So the theme of the forum for next year is Building Asian Futures, Integration, Welfare, and Growth. And we'll cover a broad range of areas, including the shift of economic power to the East, national and international relations all over Asia, and how to leverage on the region's growing economic success. Professor Calhoun is a world-renowned social scientist whose work connects sociology to culture, communications, politics, philosophy, and economics. Quite a broad range. So we'll be speaking with Professor Calhoun today about Asia as an increasingly big player in the world economy, the importance of Malaysia within the region, and the 2014 LSE Asia Forum itself. Welcome.
It's nice to be here.
So to start out, what is the Asia Forum and why was Malaysia chosen to host the Asia Forum?
The Asia Forum is an effort to look at globalization from an Asian perspective and to see the interconnection between what's happening in individual Asian countries around the region and throughout the world. So for the London School of Economics, which is Britain's most global university, the Asia Forum is a response to the fact that we don't want to see globalization only from the perspective of London, and it's important to see it from other settings. Kuala Lumpur is one of the most dynamic, rapidly growing cities in Asia. It represents part of the way in which Asia is adapting to new global circumstances, but also changing the globe. The previous Asia Forums have been held in a range of other cities like Beijing, Delhi, and Singapore, and it makes sense for us to be in Kuala Lumpur because of the growing importance of Malaysia, but also because the city itself is interesting.
And why is Kuala Lumpur as a city so interesting for the London School of Economics?
Well, one of the themes that will be addressed in the forum is the role of urbanization. And this is partly a matter of social change as people live different lives and families move from countryside into city. And this shapes how we deal with issues like care of elderly population. If children are in the city and the parents are in the countryside, that changes the traditional family mechanism. But urbanization is also a driver of growth, and cities are actually the center of Asian economic development. And that Kuala Lumpur setting is, Kuala Lumpur is a bigger and bigger part of what happens in Malaysia.
In your press release, it said, quote, "The LSE has a long-standing relationship with Malaysia," unquote. Can you explain what this relationship is?
Well, we've had Malaysian students for pretty much the whole of Malaysia's history as an independent country, and indeed even before. There are about 300 Malaysian students at the LSE now. There are alumni throughout the country who are working in leading positions in government, in private sector corporations, in education at Malaysia, in Malaysia.
Do you think Malaysia in general is well understood in the West?
No, and one of the problems with just saying Asia is a place in the world is that it hides the diversity of Asia and the very different national and sometimes even subnational, regional or local variations. So I think Asia as a whole is misunderstood because from the West it often looks like one big place. Malaysia in particular has a distinctive history that is not terribly well known. So the history of Eastern Malaysia and how it's different from some of the recent patterns of growth in the country wouldn't be something that most people in the West would know. It has a present day which is vaguely understood. People know that Malaysia is a growing economy. They know that it's a predominantly Muslim society, and that's about all they know often.
In your write-up about the forum, one of the primary speakers will be Professor Danny Kwa, a Malaysian. What will be his contribution?
Indeed. Danny is a leading professor at the London School of Economics, an economist who works on a number of issues, including the shift eastward of the center of gravity of the global economy. He's Malaysian. He's also an advisor to governments throughout Asia, and thus somebody who is able to situate Malaysian economic issues in relationship to China, to other parts of Southeast Asia.
So even though we say economic trends might be moving towards Asia, do you think in some ways the West has to catch up in terms of how it views our region, perhaps more as an equal partner or more as a powerful player than it's been in the past? So what do you think needs to happen to change this perception?
The West has been slow to understand the growth of Asia and the growing prominence of Asia in the global economy. So parts of the Asian change are understood, the idea that there are low-wage industries doing manufacturing. But the extent to which Asia is part of global finance, for example, isn't equally well understood. It's understood by professionals who work in major banks, but it's not understood by the man in the street, as it were. The extent to which the concerns of politics and economics entwine to shape different specific national expectations, national possibilities, is, I think, really important in the future and not well understood. A lot of the takeoff of Asia has come into focus for people in the West in the context of the financial crisis of 2008 and after. And people think, oh, look, Asia's taking off as we're having a problem. But Asia's been taking off since the 1970s. This is a long-term process which many in the West simply didn't wake up to until there were problems in their own economies.
So it seems like many multinationals are looking to Asia to recover their margins or to grow in new markets because their existing markets in North America or Europe have been stagnating. So do you think Asia is seen as potentially just a solution to a problem that needs a longer-term approach?
I think you're right. I think that the view of Asia is always sort of partial. So sometimes it has been low-cost labor and manufacturing. Sometimes it's been growing markets when Western markets were stagnant or contracting. Sometimes it's been the potential for investment, and this has not always been as widely recognized, that Asian economies are investors around the world. But I think in all of that, something that's missed is that there's more and more interrelationships among Asian countries, that foreign investment, for example, isn't just a matter of the West investing in Asia or Asia investing in the West. It's a matter of closer interconnections among countries throughout Asia. Foreign direct investment from one Asian country to another has grown faster than investment in Asia from the West and is at the center of a lot of the future takeoff of Asia. So the integration theme that is important to the future, to the forum that's being held in the spring, is partly about national integration, but it's largely about Asian integration.
Well, you've talked about integration. Many have criticized, for instance, Latin America or Africa, saying that these regions could punch above their weight if only united as a coherent bloc. So do you think this is a danger for ASEAN countries as well? So in other words, that countries are so focused on competition with each other and the differences between them, such as over territory, rather than focusing on joining up for common causes or becoming a much stronger political bloc if they join forces. What's your opinion?
The ASEAN region has a potential to be a much more effective global player and a much more effective collective player in Asia, in its dealings eastward and westward. In fact, the ASEAN countries have been improving their ability to have a collective policy in recent years. ASEAN has the potential to be probably the fastest growing region, certainly one of them, in the next decade or two. And that's going to depend on collective action, on being able to have a relatively organized set of relations. But it also is not just a matter of politics and foreign policy. That's important. It's a matter of infrastructure of being able to connect roads, air traffic, the ability for people to work across regions. And that is something that has become a big issue as countries may or may not accept the migration that comes with it, or they may or may not be prepared to build the infrastructure that is needed.
Thank you. Well, if you've just joined us, you've been listening to Professor Craig Calhoun, Director of the London School of Economics, here to speak to us about the upcoming LSE Asia Forum in KL next April. Coming right up, we'll talk more about the themes of the forum and the important role potentially that Malaysia can play in the coming decade. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, if you're just joining us. This is Carla Sapsford-Newman, and this is The Bigger Picture. Today, we have Professor Craig Calhoun, Director of London School of Economics, speaking with us about the upcoming LSE Asia Forum to be held in KL next April. So, tell us, who decided this theme this year, integration, welfare, and growth, and why is it timely for 2014?
Integration, welfare, and growth speaks to key issues that different countries around Asia are facing, but also issues that are really global concerns. They're concerns at the same time right here in Malaysia. And so we identified this theme with Danny Kwa, leading Malaysian economist at the LSE, and other academics looking at what are big issues on the agenda that will shape the future.
All right. Some would say Malaysia has its own challenges with integration internally. So what do you think a country like ours, which has many large vocal ethnic and various minorities, what can we learn from our neighbors and from forums like this?
Integration is an issue with many different faces. It's partly integrated markets in a country which enable goods to move and services to be shared around the country. It is partly a question of whether different ethnic groups feel that the country works in an inclusive way so that participation and opportunity are shared among different groups. The task of integration is one of making growth work for all the people in the country. And that means things like building institutions, making sure that schools, for example, are available in a way that effectively create opportunities, but also create learning about the country. And the question of integration is a communications question, whether media and communications reach everybody and are shared. Malaysia, of course, has its particular version of this, both in terms of the makeup of its peoples, but also in terms of efforts to build the national language to make sure that it's a part of the integration of the country. The importance of English is a lingua franca for many people, but a mixed one, because it isn't a national language, it's an international language, and yet it is a language that's important for lots of public affairs and business. So the capacity to speak in English becomes an access question in the development of the country.
All right. And are Malaysian examples going to be used in terms of successful integration, or how will these issues be raised and discussed, in what context?
The issues will come up throughout the forum, so it's not just one segmented issue that you deal with by itself. It's a question of growth and how it's distributed, and the Malaysian case will inform our discussion of growth. It's a question of urbanization and the way in which the growth of cities works in the country. So KL and in certain ways Penang become the sites of one kind of national integration, and a theme in the conference is the way in which the growth of cities is shaping the societies and shaping economic growth in the future.
All right. So one critique sometimes people have of KL is it's got first world infrastructure and, to use an old, perhaps outdated term, third world mentality. To what extent can cities and infrastructure drive growth and integration and forward progressive thinking, and to what extent is that just the beginning?
Cities can be more oriented to cultural change or less, but in general, cities do drive the future. People come to cities, first off, because they're seeking something. They're seeking opportunities economically, jobs, or they're coming for education and then they stay to work, or they're coming because they want to be involved in national political discussions. The idea that KL has a first-rate, first-world infrastructure and in many ways a third-world mentality seems to me a stereotype that I hope is increasingly changing. The city is one that is home to a variety of different kinds of cultural creativity. And a real question for the future is whether this is going to blossom in new kinds of industries, including cultural industries and economic opportunities, but also whether the public life of the city catches up to its economic life. KL is a driver of growth, but the public life of the city, and by that I mean not just political life, but the ability of citizens to mingle in public in a variety of different venues, in open public spaces, the way streets are organized, or in different settings, is a real question. This is a setting in which malls are important public venues. People meet each other when they're out in malls. They're shopping, yes, but they're not just running errands. This is a place in which people who come from different backgrounds brush shoulders with each other. The future development of the city can segment it so that the public spaces divide people and keep them only within their group, or they can be part of integration.
In Malaysian history, many KLites, their parents and grandparents came from the villages, the kampungs, to the big city, and that was part of a deliberate government policy, and that's it's a trend across Asia, and China is perhaps its most radical example. What do you think are some of the effects of this increasing urbanization that maybe countries need to plan for, and some of the unintended consequences?
Some of the effects of urbanization are also effects of rapid economic growth, and what they mean is that countries need to develop institutions to deal with the changing circumstances. By definition, people who've moved to the city no longer have the social support systems of the village and the extended family. So what's going to take their place? Is it going to be government institutions that provide for health care or care of the elderly? Is it going to be private market-based institutions paying for the support of, say, a home health worker or a place for an elderly parent to live? Is it going to be nonprofit organizations and charity that does this work? Everywhere in Asia, there is a challenge of building institutions so that the social welfare of society catches up to the economic growth. This isn't unique to Asia. This was true in England during the Industrial Revolution. It was true in American history. But at this moment, it's becoming a more and more acute issue in Asia. Similarly, urbanization brings with it environmental problems. And there's no easy way to avoid environmental problems, but there are very different ways in which to tackle them. And so the challenge of dealing with water and clean drinking water becomes a basic issue, of dealing with waste, of managing the air pollution, and so forth. So KL happily doesn't have the kind of problem Beijing has with air pollution, and it's in a geographic setting where it's not likely to have that bad a problem, but it's an issue nonetheless that the planning for the future needs to deal with.
All right. One of the themes of the conference is welfare. And does part of that have to do with the problem, which is global, not just in Asia, of increasing economic inequality? So the rich getting richer and much richer and the poor getting poorer or at least not improving.
The rich have gotten richer, sometimes dramatically richer, and the whole ladder of inequality has in a way been stretched out, so there are more and more levels. It's not a matter of people at the top making twice or three times what people at the bottom make. It's people at the top making 100 or 500 times what people at the bottom make. In every profession, this happens, so that it's not just that doctors and lawyers and engineers are making more, but those professions become competitive and internally unequal. So the issue of inequality is a very big, very pervasive issue. it's sometimes very stark, and we say the top 1% and the 99%, but it's a pressing issue when that happens. And throughout Asia, and I think Malaysia is no exception to this, inequality has grown rapidly with new wealth. The new wealth has gone in very unequal ways to dominant groups in society. And what that means is that not only welfare, but political stability and social harmony depend on finding ways to enable other groups to participate and benefit from the growth without alienating those who've been its primary beneficiaries so far.
All right. Do you think the example of the opening up of what's now become Russia and the Eastern Bloc and the sort of economic free-for-all and after 89, are there any lessons there for Asia in terms of how to manage economic growth in a way that's sustainable as well as equitable?
Well, there are some negative lessons and concerns. The Russian example should be a salient one for Malaysia. Both Russia and Malaysia have relatively unbalanced economies with very big contributions from natural resources, particularly oil in the Malaysian case. And this is a source of growth, but it's also potentially a limit if there isn't investment that brings the development of other sectors of the economy and wider opportunities through employment. Russia has had a really hard time accomplishing this. So looking at the Russian case reveals that this isn't an easy problem. It's always tempting to go for the continued short-term benefit from the natural resources, and it's always challenging to be able to generate more widespread and balanced growth. But if Malaysia doesn't, it will face, and it already faces to some extent, problems that Russia faces. One of those problems is brain drain, that without a more balanced economy, there aren't the range of opportunities that keep the best and the brightest at home. The best and the brightest can be engaged in building the national future if there are opportunities to advance culture and to be able to enjoy a variety of cultural opportunities, if there is a range of different fields in which they can work, if people can start new businesses and relative freedom and security and get the capital that they need to do so. So it's a meeting point of politics and culture and economics, and it's a meeting point of business opportunities. Can you start a company? Cultural opportunities. Can you produce a play that has some critical edge to it and both find an audience and be free from censorship? Can you make a movie and have an audience that's perhaps an international audience for it and thus an economic success, but also be able to say something that you believe in? So the danger, and Russia is a very strong example of this danger, is that the people who could start those new companies, who could make those movies, decide to do it abroad. And then the country doesn't benefit as much from it as it might.
So your Professor Kwa is one of those who have left.
Danny is one who has sought opportunities outside. I think that he remains closely engaged with Malaysia, as indeed many people who migrate around the world maintain close connections. But he also saw wonderful university opportunities. And one of the questions is, will Malaysia build higher education? Will it have universities that create the same sort of opportunities so that a young economist today will say, I can be a great economist working here. I can have just the same opportunities, whether I'm educated here or I go abroad for education and come back. And Malaysians who graduate with world-class education face choices. Malaysia is, I think, actually at the point that it is becoming more and more attractive. So more of its own people can find jobs. Others from outside come here for work. But it depends on diversifying the economy, and it depends on opening up social participation, and it depends on having the kind of cultural amenities that highly educated people like. And that's, again, why KL becomes part of the story, and indeed Penang. The cities are the places to which those highly educated, highly skilled, economically productive people will potentially return, and how the life of those cities develops will shape whether they return.
Okay. Let's talk about higher education for a moment. Malaysia has consistently been slipping in the Times rankings of universities. And so there's and every year we speak to the editor, Phil Bhatti, and it seems like there are some consistent trends for why that is so, and one of which is a lack of research and development of the kind that is rewarded in the rankings, and also much lower publication rates. Can you say anything to the Malaysian higher education industry in general about what they might do to address some of these perceived shortages in our system?
Sure. Malaysia has a base in higher education. The question is partly whether it has the investment to grow stronger and whether it has the opportunities to be a relatively meritocratic system in which the quality of work governs promotions and advancement. The higher education around the world has very seldom reached the highest standards where it is pursued as an industry on a profit basis. It's required government support or the support of wealthy people and charities within a society to get to that level. I wouldn't obsess over rankings. I don't think rankings tell the whole story. Rankings, for example, are biased towards publications in English. Many Malaysian scholars do publish in English, but of course others are publishing in Bahasa. And the language of publication is one issue. But the amount of research, the creation of new knowledge is important. Higher education rankings reflect the way in which universities are able to teach and are able to generate new knowledge and are able to carry on the scholarship and the knowledge that comes from the past. And I think all of these are patterns for development. They also reflect the extent to which universities do public engagement, right? So teaching, research, scholarship, public engagement, these are what need to be developed. The choice that comes is about whether there is enough of an investment being made to offer the high end of higher education that gives it that name, higher education, or whether there's only basic skills training. And the future choice keeps confronting an escalation of standards. Global higher education gets stronger and stronger, so doing the same thing means that Malaysia may fall behind. For Malaysia to do better, it has to support having top-level professors so they don't lose them to abroad. The universities in Malaysia need to support the development of new knowledge through research, and they need to support students at top levels as well as basic levels in the different subjects that they teach. I think all of those are within grasp. These are not unrealizable, but they will all take investments.
And time.
They will certainly all take time to achieve. That's right. This cannot be done overnight.
If we can talk about branding for a moment, LSE has a very good reputation for training not only economists but social scientists and a broad range of disciplines. But a couple years ago, the brand took a hit with a particular PhD graduate, the son of Muammar Gaddafi. Can you address some of the criticisms that were leveled at the LSE and whether they were perhaps fair or maybe have caused the LSE brand to be slightly tarnished since that incident?
Sure. I think that the issue of having Saif al-Islam Gaddafi and, say, student and the criticism of the LSE produced a sort of temporary storm, a media flurry, particularly in London, and relatively little long-term damage to the brand. It's precisely because the LSE is famous and attractive that the sons of people like Muammar Gaddafi, as well as millions of other students, want to go there. And so it's a more or less inevitable feature of being a high-quality university that it will attract a wide range of students, some of whom you will be more proud of than others. The issue that should really be at the center is one of what's the mission of the school and does it live up to it? And the LSE certainly teaches social sciences. As you say, the mission is around social sciences and closely related fields like law and management. And we do key work in those areas. The mission is to be global and thus to reach out to other countries. So I have wanted to make sure the LSE doesn't draw the wrong conclusions from this. The right conclusion is, of course, that we need to be sure we maintain ethical standards in our work, that we have proper standards for admission, that it's not based on who your father is, but on your academic achievements, and that we have proper standards for our finances. But the lessons are not that we should pull back from being global or that we shouldn't work in parts of the world. We should still work in North Africa. We should still work all around the world because that's our mission. We shouldn't say that just because some part of the world has produced civil war and upheaval, we should turn our backs on it. We should be engaged. So I think that the question for the LSE was which lesson to draw. The school correctly drew the lesson that it should look hard at making sure that its ethical procedures were sound. And then we realized that there was a risk of becoming less publicly engaged or less international, and that we didn't want to fall into that. We wanted to keep to our mission of reaching out to the rest of the world. So occasionally somebody from outside has criticized the school and said, well, why do you work in China? It's not a democracy. Why do you work someplace else where we disagree with things? And we point out that the question of whether a country has our values isn't the only question to be asked. The question is whether we can work in a way that is true to our values and work every place around the world that we want to. And the answers are yes. So we work in countries that are democratic and not democratic. We work in ways that reflect our academic integrity and our ethical standards wherever we work.
And to be fair, my alma mater accepted someone from the Syrian regime's inner circle into its School for International Public Affairs, and they received a very similar firestorm for taking on someone from a very problematic.
I can guess which alma mater you're talking about.
Yes.
This is, I think, normal. So I think that the firestorms happen occasionally, but this is also part of progress because the people who benefit from a really strong education with strong academic values, but also an engagement with students from other countries and broader knowledge of the world, are going to be better positioned to become good leaders in the future. So that doesn't guarantee that every individual will. It goes the same for business leaders. Business leaders who benefit from knowing more about other countries, who benefit from understanding the kind of ethical standards that are taught in leading business schools, are more likely to be good, responsible business leaders. They're more likely to create foundations and help society with some of their profits. But there's no guarantee. They could also be greedy. And I think that we have to accept that that's part of the freedom that people have. They can determine whether they're going to be highly ethical or less ethical. And universities can't close themselves off. I think that sometimes there's an idea that the best way for a university to work is to somehow separate itself from everything in the world it doesn't like. But that would be really counterproductive, both for the world and for the advancement of academic knowledge.
And that's a good note to end on. That would seem to tie into the mission of the forum as well.
Indeed. The mission of the forum is to build better connections so that our knowledge reflects different points of view, to understand what's going on in Asia, and that it's not just one thing. The different Asian countries are following different paths and trajectories, and to help people from around Asia engage with each other and with leading scholars from the West in thinking about the future and in choosing the future through good policy.
Thank you. What a great note to end on. We've been speaking with Professor Craig Calhoun of the London School of Economics. He is a director there, and we've been talking about the upcoming LSE Asia Forum to be held in KL in April 2014. We've also spoken about the role Malaysia is playing in global economic development and other educational trends across the world. More information about the Asia Forum can be found on the LSE website. You are listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.